Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday, November the 10th. Today, Barack Obama plans to quickly reverse some of George Bush's policies, including on stem cell research and oil and gas drilling. We hear from the president of the Royal Society, who speaks for Britain's scientists, on his hopes for Obama's presidency.
The US has been held back in its research on topics like stem cells because of the federal government's attitude. I hope you coordinate that.
Also today, poorer children are less likely to be receiving an adequate nursery education, according to official figures.
What the Conservatives say is that this is a widening of the gap in standards of provision for under five between the richest and poorest areas of the country.
And as climate change threatens the very existence of the Maldives, the country's new leader considers buying land elsewhere.
The president told me that he's looked at three countries, Sri Lanka and India, because culturally similar, the cuisine is similar, and they've also looked at Australia.
But first, let's hear today's news headlines and find out what the papers are saying. Here's Sandy Waugh.
Barack Obama will move swiftly to unpick many of what he sees as the most glaring acts of the Bush administration when he enters the White House in January. A leading member of his transition team says that'll include the restrictions placed on stem cell research, as well as moves allowing oil drilling in wilderness areas. John Podesta, a former chief of staff to Bill Clinton, indicated the incoming president would use extraordinary powers to force through rapid change. Podesta also added that even today, the Bush administration is moving aggressively to do things that are probably not in the interest of the country. These comments could be interpreted as a warning to the current occupants of the White House not to forge ahead with controversial decisions in the weeks of transition, a ploy used by many outgoing presidents. Later in this programme, we'll be hearing from the president of Britain's Royal Society on what scientific challenges the new president-elect faces. Zimbabwe's opposition has rejected calls from Southern African leaders to split the leadership of a key ministry. It's a further sign power-sharing talks are unravelling. A resolution from the 15-nation Southern African Development Community says Zimbabwe's squabbling political parties should form a unity government immediately to end a stalemate over the allocation of ministries. But opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai says he's shocked and saddened by the outcome of the summit. The main sticking point in the talks was over the Home Affairs Department, which controls the country's police. Doctors are struggling to contain an outbreak of cholera in a sprawling refugee camp near Congo's eastern provincial capital of Goma. It says renewed fighting has ignited fears patients could scatter and launch an epidemic. Congolese soldiers and rebels have been seen less than 800 metres apart near Goma. The organisation Doctors Without Borders says it's seen 45 cases of cholera since Friday in Kibati, which is 7 miles from Goma. Officials say shortages of water and latrines are making the outbreak very dangerous. In recent weeks, dozens of people have died from the disease elsewhere in eastern Congo. Gordon Brown is to call for a new global financial system. In a speech later today, the Prime Minister will say he wants to update the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement and will call for the reforms at next weekend's G20 summit in Washington. He'll suggest a new international monetary fund that'll watch every economy and be an early warning system, as well as a crisis prevention mechanism for the whole world. Brown will also say the US and Europe must provide the leadership for the creation of a new international order. A group of MPs is calling for a ban on happy hour drink promotions. They also want supermarkets to be prevented by law from selling alcohol at a loss to encourage people into their stores. The Home Affairs Select Committee highlighted research showing the real price of beer, spirits and wine has fallen dramatically and found police resources were focused on targeting booze-fuelled and football violence, meaning officers were hitting their targets but missing the point. Quick look at this morning's papers now. The broadsheets and the Mail feature pictures of yesterday's Remembrance Sunday service at the Cenotaph in London. The Telegraph runs a piece on new statins research. It suggests millions could reduce the chance of a heart attack and stroke by taking the cholesterol-lowering drugs. The Mail also covers this, saying you don't even need to have bad cholesterol to use them. MPs seek to censor the media is the headline in The Independent, saying the intelligence services and police could be given new powers to ban reports on the grounds of national national security. The Times says there's to be a review of free housing, which could mean the end of council homes for life. The Mirror's front page pictures an Ipswich footballer's goal celebrations in what it calls a sick handcuffs gesture to a jailed drink drive killer. They say David Norris made the tribute to Luke McCormick, who's serving a 7-year sentence for killing two young brothers. The Sun's furious at exam chiefs who are suggesting students study a song by paedophile Gary Glitter. And many of the back pages are catching up with Joe Calzaghe's win. The Welsh boxer beat Roy Jones Jr. in the early hours of Sunday morning. Predictably, most are pondering whether or not this is the end of his career. According to the Star, Joe says his mum will kill him if he doesn't throw in the towel for good. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
President-elect Barack Obama looks to quickly reverse some of President George Bush's policies. He's likely to lift the ban on stem cell research and halt oil and gas drilling in environmentally sensitive public land in Utah. That's according to Obama's transition chief, John Podesta, who said that a president can use his executive authority without getting a vote of approval from Congress. Podesta's comments signal a change in direction for the US on the environment and science. Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society, told The Guardian's James Randerson of our Science Weekly podcast of his hopes for the Obama presidency.
I hope that within the US he will accelerate the blitz on clean energy R&D, because clearly he realizes that they need to ease their dependence on oil, and we need to take measures to reduce CO2 emissions. And I hope he will give that the sort of priority which the Apollo program had. Of course, the US has been held back in its research on topics like stem cells because of the federal government's attitude, which is out of line with many states. I hope you coordinate that so that US scientists are not handicapped.
Bush had some fairly ambitious plans in the long term of, you know, going back to the moon and establishing a base there. I mean, do you think he was on the right lines, or should Obama go in different directions?
Well, if I was an American, I wouldn't have supported the Bush program. Indeed, I personally wouldn't support a major publicly funded manned program at all. But I think there's tremendous opportunity for the use of robotics and miniaturization to get far better value from space and space exploration. And this is something which obviously all countries in the world should be trying to do. And I hope that the US will do that. In practice, of course, the political pressure to have the manned program is crucial. In particular, he'll be under great pressure to reduce the gap between when the shuttle goes out of service and when its successor comes into service, because that's going to be a gap during which only the Russians will have access to the space station.
What kind of message do you think the UK science community would want to send to Obama as he settles down in the Oval Office?
Well, I think the UK sees the US obviously as its prime collaborator in science, but I think there are a number of issues where we've almost despaired about America. For instance, its educational level at high schools is not very good, and the Americans realize this. They succeed by draining the rest of the world of talent, but I think they realize, and their National Academy of Sciences pointed out, that they need to improve education at the school level, and I'm sure they'll do that. And also, one final thing, which one is sure that Obama will prioritize more than Bush, and that is trying to achieve the Millennium Development Goals for Africa and the rest of the world, because it's really depressing that the UN target of 0.7% of GNP being used for overseas aid is not being met in most countries, and the country that falls short by the biggest factor is the United States, and that's really disgraceful, and I really hope that he will change that.
Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society. And that interview's from a special edition of our Science Weekly podcast this week, looking at the implications of Barack Obama's election victory for science and the environment. Listen to it at guardian.co.uk/audio. Also on The Guardian's website today, what will Sarah Palin do next? Ed Pilkington reports from Alaska, guardian.co.uk/America for that. Max Hastings says about the Bloody Sunday inquiry, it serves no real purpose. The hearings ended in 2004, but the report won't appear for another year. That's what happens when lawyers can graze unchecked, he says. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And our technology correspondent, Bobby Johnson, on Facebook, it's still focusing on expanding before making a profit. Do social networking sites need to grow up and face the reality of the new economic order, he asks, at guardian.co.uk/media. In the poorest areas of England, the number of nurseries that have failed Ofsted tests has doubled over the last year. That's according to official figures obtained by the Conservatives. Meanwhile, the standard of nurseries in wealthier districts has improved. Polly Curtis, our education editor, has the details.
These figures show that there's been a marked change in the quality of nurseries over the last year. In the poorest areas of the country, the number of failing nurseries has doubled, going up from 6.6% of all nurseries in those wards to 10% judged failing. Meanwhile, in the richest areas of the country, nurseries are improving at a steady rate. So what the Conservatives, who got these questions through a parliamentary question, say is that this is a widening of the gap in standards of provision for under fives between the richest and poorest areas of the country.
Is that a conclusion that they are entitled to make on the basis of these figures?
These figures are, they're the government's own figures, so the figures themselves are not disputed. The fact that it's only over 1 year and it's quite small numbers of nurseries that were inspected and found to be failing, the academics I've been talking to about this are warning that perhaps it's too soon to make any kind of strong judgment that this trend is getting worse. But what they do say is that this is a fact, that in the poorest areas of the country you're more likely to have failing nurseries and lower quality nurseries than you are anywhere else in the country. And it's the same problem you get in schools. It's harder to attract the very best staff, and they've got a bigger problem. They've got a bigger task to do, because the pupils going to nurseries and schools in those poorest areas come with lower skills to start with and more social problems than you'd find in richer areas.
The Tories say that Sure Start, the government's flagship programme for helping children in more deprived communities, is failing to reach out to these families. Again, is that a conclusion that they're entitled to make?
Well, the most recent evidence that looked just at Sure Start found that it after a slow start, it is improving provision. But on the basis of these figures, I think that's probably a difficult conclusion, or it's a bit of a leap, because these are small numbers. And we also don't know of the settings that they looked at in these figures. We don't know whether they're Sure Start, they're private nurseries, they're nurseries attached to schools. We don't know what kind of settings they are, so we can't kind of single out Sure Start.
When we will be able to make some sort of judgment on how well the government's doing in providing nursery care?
Well, I think that Ofsted makes ongoing judgments. Their most recent report looked at the last 3 years worth of inspections of nursery settings and found that 40% weren't good enough, which means that they're judged satisfactory or inadequate, which Ofsted says isn't good enough. And I think what worried a lot of parents about that report was that only 3% of nurseries are outstanding. And as a parent, you want an outstanding setting. You don't want satisfactory.
Polly Curtis. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, Britain's hill farmers are going out of business, and that could destroy some of our most cherished landscapes forever.
If you'd been here 100, 200 years ago, you would have seen a completely different landscape. Most of the quaint cottages and adjoining barns that we see as we travel through the Lake District were originally farms in their own right.
But first, the Russian military is investigating an accident aboard a nuclear-powered submarine, killed 20 people and injured 21 others. A lethal gas was released when something went wrong with the fire safety system during a test run in the Sea of Japan. Tom Parfitt, our correspondent in Moscow, he says it's Russia's worst naval accident since the Kursk.
Well, it seems that the submarine was involved in sea trials off Russia's Pacific coast, off Vladivostok, and there was an accidental triggering of its fire extinguishing system, and that accidental triggering caused a gas called freon to be released, and that gas is normally released in a closed area in order to use up oxygen so that a fire goes out, but it seems that the system was triggered so that the gas was released into areas where people were, and those people were poisoned by the gas.
Back in 2000, President Vladimir Putin was heavily criticised for refusing to cut short his holiday when crew aboard the Kursk submarine were dying. That was another nuclear submarine. 118 people died on that occasion. How's the Russian government responded this time?
I think they're a lot wiser now, John, to these things. It was immediately said that President Dmitry Medvedev was closely following what was happening. There were several briefings given by the Navy to say what was going on. But clearly there will still be a lot of questions asked about how many people died from apparently such an innocuous accident.
What does this say about the state of Russia's military hardware?
Well, I think it's another blow for Moscow, really, especially at a time when it's trying to project itself as a resurgent military power. Its expansion of naval power is certainly a key plank in Russia's attempt to increase its military reach across the globe. It's sending a naval task force to Venezuela later this month. That's seen very much as a kind of snub to the US and a suggestion that Russia is expanding its naval might and its military might in general. So these kind of accidents, which have been quite frequent over the past few years, especially with submarines, are a terrible blow to that idea of resurgence.
Meanwhile, Tom, with Barack Obama preparing to take over from George Bush at the White House, there's been some diplomatic activity between Moscow and Washington.
That's right. You may remember that the day after Obama became president of the US, President Dmitry Medvedev here in Russia gave his annual speech to Parliament, and while the rest of the world appeared to be celebrating and greeting Obama's victory, he rather sharply said that Russia was going to place short-range missiles in its Kaliningrad region right in Europe in response to U.S. plans to create a missile defense shield in Europe. So there's been quite a lot of diplomatic activity after that. On Saturday, Medvedev and Obama spoke by telephone. It seems perhaps they were trying to calm things a little bit and agreed that they would meet soon, that they should have a common interest in ensuring world security. And also on the same day, on Saturday, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, met with Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State in the US. And they also talked about the fact that new talks should be started on strategic nuclear missiles.
And a meeting between Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev might take place as soon as next week.
That's right. Next week there will be the G20 talks in Washington on the global financial crisis. President Medvedev will be going there for his first visit to the States, and it's quite possible that he will be able to meet Obama on the fringes of those talks.
Tom Parfitt in Moscow. The Maldives' 300,000 islanders are to buy a new homeland as climate change threatens the very existence of their country. The Maldives are a chain of 1,200 islands and coral atolls 500 miles from the southern tip of India. But they'll disappear under the waves if global warming continues to raise sea levels. Mohamed Nasheed, the Maldives' first democratically elected president, takes power tomorrow. Randeep Ramesh, our Asia correspondent, has been to the Maldives to interview him. We apologise for the sound quality of this interview.
Well, the new president who was elected at the end of last month, is a guy called Mohamed Nasheed. Now, he has taken a look at the problems that are confronting the Maldives, which is a sort of chain of 1,200 low-lying islands, and said, you know, we've really got to consider what happens if the world continues to pollute in the manner that it has done, and the seas rise, because the Maldives is only 1.5 meters above sea level at its average. Now, that might not sound very much, but if the seas rise by 60 centimeters, as they're supposed to, in the next century, most of the Maldives will be inundated. So his reasoning was, well, let's consider the worst possible option. What do we have to do? Well, he said, well, I think we have to buy ourselves a new state, a new homeland. And that's what he's begun to see how the Maldives could do.
How can the Maldivians afford to buy land on this scale?
Well, the Maldives isn't, it's still officially a poor country, although it's the richest in South Asia. But like Arab states that have oil, the Maldives has tourism. And it generates about $1 billion of tourist revenue. And it's creating what's called a sovereign wealth fund, which is rather like the Arab states who invest in companies in the West using the money they've generated through oil sales. The money generated by importing tourists, the Maldives is going to invest in land. And that land they've considered to be their new homeland, should their islands disappear and they become islanders without islands, I suppose. Now, the president told me that he's looked at three countries, Sri Lanka and India, because culturally similar, the cuisine is similar, and the climate is similar to the Maldives. And they've also looked at Australia because it's a large, unoccupied country. So the idea is that if they are taking out an insurance policy against climate change, that might turn them into environmental refugees. And he said, I don't want to see my people living in tents.
And they're citing as a precedent for this the Israelis' purchase of Palestinian land in the 20th century.
Well, it was, yeah, said half in jest when I pointed out whether anybody else had bought land. And he said, well, after all, the Israelis began by buying land in Palestine. So it's not unusual. I mean, land is commercially available. You buy it. That was his kind of statement. So I think he says that I want to do this. I don't want to leave the Maldives, you know. But he says, can I do it? The rest of the world doesn't really care if the Maldives disappears beneath the waves. Then I have to care what happens to the Maldives.
Randeep Ramesh. The way hill farmers are funded is changing, and it's driving many of them out of business. Well, that could change some of the UK's wildest landscapes forever. It's feared that the loss of hill farms in areas like Dartmoor and the Lake District will have a disastrous impact on nature, on tourism, water supplies, and even on the climate. Martin Wainwright reports from the Lake District.
I'm just being driven through the most beautiful place in England in my view, the Lake District. We're just on our way from Grasmere towards Ambleside, and I'm with Neil Johnson, who's the farming and countryside officer for the National Trust in this part of the world. The National Trust owns 90 farms in the Lake District, and these are all upland farms, mostly involving sheep. And I've come to discover about the Herdwick Management Project.
The Herdwick Project was a project we ran for over 5 years, but we're always looking at new opportunities and new ways of adding value to the Herdwick breed, which is unique to the Lake District.
And the thing that motivated you to do this was a crisis in upland sheep farming?
Upland farming has always been on the fringe of agricultural systems. It's always been the poor relation. It's always been the first sector to suffer in agricultural recessions and the last sector to recover when agricultural fortunes improved. That historically has always been the picture and continues to be. In the past, most farms were part-time farms, and those farmers were also employed in mining, in forestry and charcoal production. All the other industries in the Lake District have long since disappeared, leaving agriculture and tourism, but those farms still remain very, very, very poor economically.
Neil, we're up at Blee Town Farm now, and the farmhouse here, which is no longer a farm, it's now cottages and rented out. Do you get people, when one of these farms falls vacant, do you get enough people interested in taking them over as tenants?
Yes, we always get a lot of interest, and I'm sure we always will, because they are farms in the Lake District, and people aspire to the lifestyle that they associate with living in the Lake District. I think in recent years, what we have seen is a reduction in the number of good applicants, people who have the skills and the wherewithal and the experience and the financial capital behind them to make a success of these farms and to deliver the landscape management objectives which we set.
Because a sort of
one of these, you know, telly workers, I mean, like, you know, a journalist even, wouldn't be the right person to take on one of these places unless they had a passion for farming as well.
Absolutely. It's a hard, hard life. And the skills and the experience needed to manage sheep on open fell and heath sheep in extreme climates is not for the faint-hearted.
The number of farms in the Lake District has gone down and down.
Oh, yes, absolutely. If you'd been here 100, 200 years ago, you would have seen a completely different landscape. Most of the quaint cottages and adjoining barns that we see as we travel through the Lake District were originally farms in their own right. And there would have been one or more families living in those, being largely self-sufficient and farming a relatively small area of land. Over the last 100 years, we've seen a very rapid reduction in the number of farms, a rapid increase in the size of farms, and a very, very large increase in the number of people employed in agriculture. That's part and parcel of change and modern life.
Here we are wearing these various clothes and things that have cost a fortune in carbon footprints and petrochemicals and so on compared to what we've got around us here.
Yeah, I just think it's truly ironic that wool is a natural, sustainable material which for hundreds of years has provided warmth through clothing, through house insulation, and has got a multitude of uses, has gone out of fashion and is now practically a waste product, whilst we surround ourselves with materials which are man-made, derived from petrochemicals and oils, or from intensive agriculture requiring large inputs of fertiliser and pesticides, both of which also derive from oil. Increasingly, as oil prices rise, there's a lot of talk about peak oil and sustainability and low footprints and such like. We have a natural, sustainable product on the backs of these sheep that has got practically no value. It seems crazy.
Martin Wainwright, Sonia Rothwell and Andy Duckworth produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.